I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Story Studio. Oh yeah, here we go. Check it out now.
Welcome to the Story Studio, a podcast for an independent publishing company, explores the world of self-publishing, independent art, and the future of the storytelling thing. My name is Luke, and today I'm joined by my regular co-host, Mr.
Daniel Wilcox.
Daniel Wilcox. How's it going, man? You're right.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, all right. How are you?
Yeah, we are having...
How are you, audience?
We are having, like, technology strife at the minute, because... So you're doing this from your phone because your MacBook Pro has not been acting very pro. It's not being professional at all. MacBook amateur. And yeah. So Skype in the interview, today's interview, got a great interview lined up for you guys. Skype just kept on, like, you'll notice, like, some of the editing might be a little bit choppy, and because Keelan was I guess was saying some really great stuff. But then Skype just kept, like, fizzling out. Like, it just couldn't handle the awesomeness that Keelan was saying.
Do you think there's a conspiracy? Like, he'd get rolling on a really good point, and then Skype just goes, shh.
Yeah, maybe. It's trying to silence him. Yeah, this is, we're in the age of censorship now. Yeah, the age of Donald Trump. but yeah, no, so we had loads of technology issues. Is anyone out there listening and they sort of know a good alternative to using... instead of using Skype for podcasting and recording, that doesn't cost a load of, like, subscription money, let us know, because I'm getting sick of Skype. it's cost me for the last time.
Yeah, it has to be so that the guests can do it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is going to be tricky, but I'm sure there's something out there. There must be in this wonderful world of internet.
Yeah, well, if we get a few more patrons, we could fly people over from America to our kitchen table.
And where would we get patrons from?
At our Patreon, at patreon.com/HawkandCleaver. And you can pledge from as little as a pound or a dollar, depending where you're from. Yeah. So have you got a big book for us then?
I do. I actually have two, which I don't know if I save one for next week or if I just hit them both now. Should I just hit them both now?
Hit them both now, because you probably forget the one for next week.
Okay.
My
first one is Story Shop Writer, which I think I mentioned Story Shop as my big whip a couple of months ago when the self-publishing podcast guys released their new software for planning books and stories. But they've now released the second part of that, which is the writing tool, which basically is a way, it's kind of like, I don't want to say it because it's not a replacement for those that love Scrivener, but it does a lot of what Scrivener does in that it brings all of those beats of character planning into one cloud service that lets you write your book and just have it automatically back up, which is incredibly handy and timely for me because, like we say, my MacBook's currently playing up. So I've had to somehow save my files from dying into the ether, and I've popped them into the cloud where the angels sing.
Nice. I like it.
Yeah. And do you want to do one and then I'll do one? So
yeah, sure.
Don't sicken my voice.
Mine might be the same as yours. So my big whip is we are, as a company, going to be appearing at the Nottingham Comic Con. When is it? So the 14th of October, 2017. at the Nottingham Conference Centre. It's my home city, in a sense. So it'd be cool to go back there, and it'd be cool to sell some books, sell some comics, meet some readers, meet a lot of other creators who we sort of have mingled with but never actually met in person. So, yeah, come down to that if you're in the area. Come say hello. And also, Joey Oliveri will be there. He was on one of our previous podcast episodes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it'd be cool to catch up with everyone.
What about Frizzon? Frizzon Comics going to be there.
I'll have a quick look. Whilst I'm doing that, do you want to give your other big whoop?
Yeah, my other big whoop is, have you seen American Vandal?
No, but I see the trailer.
I think American Vandal has literally made my life complete.
Is it? Because I kind of looked at it and thought that could just be a 5-minute sketch. Surely, like, I don't see how they can do 8 episodes of that.
It's an entire show. So just to set the scene for people that might not be aware of it, the premise is basically it's a fake documentary that is beautifully filmed about a high school in America where during a half-hour period, someone spray-painted 27 penises on 27 staff members' cars. In the school is a student who is famed for drawing penises on things and is expelled, and all the evidence points to him. And it's basically the documentarian's mission to get to the bottom of it and to find out who's actually telling the truth. I can't remember the last time I've laughed out loud so much at a series. Really? It's stupid humor, but it's the way that it's documentary filmed, and they bring in bits of Snapchat, and they bring in like just tiny little ways that people spell stuff in text as some of the clues, and yeah, it's just fantastic.
It's like ripe, isn't it, because you've got all the Making of a Murderer, confession tapes, the Jinx, all of those sort of programs going on right now. And it's the right time to have something like this come out. But 8 episodes, I don't know.
It's so stupid, and it's so brilliant.
Cool. I'll do one more big whoop just to match you, because we're only 6 minutes in, and we normally go a little bit longer. So the new season of Channel Zero is out. Well, the first episode is. It's based on a creepypasta called No End House. They do like 6 episode miniseries, and each series is like a different creepypasta. And this is the second one. The first season was one of my favorite things I saw this year. And the first episode is on YouTube for free for anyone out there to go watch it. Yeah, and it's really good. Like, it makes American Horror... I think the people who write American Horror Story plot their stories with Boggle. Like, either compared to this, compared to like how like clean and tight this Channel Zero is.
There's
how,
a million-dollar idea.
Yeah. But, American Horror Story, although I keep watching it and I do kind of enjoy it, Channel Zero is just, you know, it's a level up. It's 5 guys compared to McDonald's. Although I enjoy both.
Yeah, that's a weird comparison. But no, I get that. So that's on the first episode on YouTube. Where can people catch the rest of it?
I have no idea yet. I think, I'm sure it'll pop up on Netflix or, you know, something soon, or Amazon. But check out the first episode. It's good. Like, it's very, very creepy.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah. Which leads us into our guest today. I won't do the intro now because we'll do it in a sec. But I've been looking forward to getting this guy on for a while. And we talked about one of his books, like, early this year, I think.
But Sour Candy.
Yeah. So, yeah, the interview is lots of good stuff in here. There's a bit of a conversation about, like, you know, the difference between writing to market and staying true to your heart and what you want to write. It's all very deep, Dan had a little bit of a therapy session halfway through.
I'll add a little footnote there and say that at the time of recording the interview, it was after an incredibly long day at work, and I was at my most vulnerable, and I was held in the arms of an Irishman and told to assess my vision as a writer. So that, there's that to look forward to, but yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, guys, we will see you on the other side. Today we're talking to a former waiter, drama teacher, map maker, security guard, assembly line worker, salesman, bartender, landscape gardener, vocalist in a rock band, curriculum content editor, fiction editor at gothic.net, fraud investigator, but now he's an acclaimed horror author and cover designer, and Mr. Keelan Patrick Burke. Keelan's written 5 novels, over 100 short stories, 6 collections, edited 4 acclaimed anthologies. In 2004, he was honored with the Bram Stoker Award for his novella, The Turtle Boy, and he's just cracked out a new novella called Blanky. So welcome to the show, Keelan.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So first question, I guess, is like, how can you have had so many jobs? What's going on there? I
believe the term in Ireland was waster. You know, I just, I didn't particularly enjoy any of them. And, you know, I mean, as anybody knows, like, you know, when you start out, the jobs you do are entirely for, you know, just for the money so that you can survive. And while that doesn't change much over time, as you go to college, as you get educated for stuff and you narrow your focus into the kind of jobs that you actually want to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was legitimately interested in some of those jobs, like the map making one in particular. I was just terrible at most of them. So I would do it as long as I could until I could find something else, and then I'd move from one job to the next. And
no one seems to understand that it's just for the money when you're younger. No one seems to get that.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, you know, the preference would be not to work at all, just to sit at home and play video games. But
yeah,
you know,
you got to have the money to do that. So you have to pick up whatever job you can. And unfortunately, before you're qualified to do very much of anything, you just take what you're offered. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
And I did enjoy the last job that I had. Fraud investigator job was interesting because I think it was basically dealing with people that you frequently had to catch them out in lies at the top. It was very interesting. This kind of psychological appeal of it to me, where I just was sitting across from somebody and I had the facts in front of me. And they would just blatantly lie. And some people are so fantastically good at it that I was enthralled by the deception, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
So, but that's fun. But, you know, other than that, I'm doing exactly what I think I was born to do now and have no intention of giving it up unless, you know, my predators come from my thumbs and I have no choice.
Yeah. You know, when you caught someone in the act of lying, what did you do? Did you, like, blow a raspberry at them? Or how did you...
No, we usually just throw them out the window.
Right.
The office was 6 floors
I prefer
up,
that one.
Yeah. Immediately took care of the problem.
does that appear in any of your books, you throwing someone out of a 6th floor window?
No. I tend to fictionalize it for the sake of the true life events, and I usually make it the 4th floor. So there's a hope of surviving.
Yeah. So all these jobs kind of must play into, like, the writing inspiration anyway, right? I mean, all of this stuff all adds to the patchwork of who you are, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it all falls under the umbrella of that writerly wisdom that if you haven't lived, you can't write a convincing novel. I mean, you can't write characters if you haven't lived a life that has many, many different chapters and a lot of variety. If you've never been in love and had your heart broken, if you've never lost somebody or at least come rushed a passing acquaintance with death and mortality. I mean, these are all the things I think you need to learn. It's as important, if not more important, than a formal education, I think.
Hmm.
No, I've read books by people who just, you know, people who say they've had a charmed life. They grew up with money and never had to struggle for anything. And I don't know whether it's my own bitterness at play when I read their books, but I just don't find them terribly convincing because I think that if you haven't been exposed to the worst parts of life, that you can't convincingly write about them.
Interesting. Like, a lot of writers in the olden days were, you know, upper class people because
literary wasn't
really a pastime for the working class.
Yep. That's absolutely true. And I don't know what changed or, like I said, whether it's just my own perception of it, but, you know, to that end, you had then, of course, had writers like Edgar Allan Poe, who died in the gutter, you know,
and was
half friggin' mad. And if you look at artists, some of the greatest artists, painters in the world were completely batshit crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was it about? So all these jobs are obviously very, very different. What was it? What was the big push that led you towards writing? Do you want to give our listeners just a little overview on how you went from this amalgamation of stuff into doing what you do now?
Well, writing, excuse me, writing was all I ever wanted to do. And I think I knew from probably 5 years of age that's what I was going to do if there was any justice and if I was allowed any kind of control and if my destiny was even listening, that's what I wanted to be always. So, I mean, it wasn't just a case of going from those jobs into writing. It was that I was always, I believe I was always a writer and had to do the jobs out of economical necessity, you know, because to be a writer does not pay the bills. And even 90% of the time, writing itself doesn't pay the bills. So, you know, I knew that's what I was going to do. And I just basically fought tooth and nail through my life to date to get to the point where I had the option of sitting down and writing for a living.
From the age of 5, you sat down and you wrote a horror story? Or when did you start writing horror?
No. My mom had me reading and writing at an advanced level. She was just basically putting them in front of me, encouraging me to read things that looked like complete, you know, I had no idea what I was looking at, but I learned because I felt like I could do it. And that kind of followed me through life, and I started sketching out rudimentary stories at a very, very young age, started writing actual stories by the time I was 8, got a typewriter by the time I was 10. I had no choice, and it wasn't forced on me. It was something I knew. I loved it. I loved reading. I loved stories, and I wanted to be able to do that for other people. As long as I can remember, that was pretty much the drive.
So was there any particular writer who you read and thought, I want to do what that guy did?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because some of the earliest stuff I read were the abridged classics, like The Count of Monte Cristo and Ivanhoe and Oliver Twist, all that kind of stuff. But even those engaged me, I think, at a level. It wasn't even so much the story, which I remember really enjoying, but it was also the illustrations. I don't know if you can remember, but back then you'd have children's books with the most horrific friggin' illustrations in them.
Yeah.
They were just terrifying. And there was one that showed that a young man at the door was holding the lamp and the light rays were shining into this old man's big giant eagle eye. And he was curled in on himself in the bed, one hand raised to try and shield himself. And I remember that affected me greatly. I thought that terrified me at the time. And rather than being repelled by it, I found it intoxicating. So I thought, well, you know, just every passing day, every new experience in the literary regard makes me just desperate to want to do it myself for other people. And I never lost that. I'm still doing it. That's still what I do. I will write something and then go, yeah, but that's not scaring me. So it's no good. We got to make it. We got to amp it up. So that's the kind of thing that you read it, your eyes move past the lines, and then you go back up again and go, well, wait a minute, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
And your hair stands on end, you know?
I think that's the sweet spot that I kind of get scared by when I'm trying to write my stories, is you get to that point where you're just like, am I going too far? But I think you're right in that if you are writing because you are your own audience, you need to get yourself to that point. Otherwise, you're not really serving your job as a horror writer.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to keep pushing it. You can't be content with the tools that have worked before. You go, okay, well, if I've already given you in the last book something that really worked for you, how do I improve upon that? I'm not in the business of repeating myself. I want to push it to the point where I wake up in the middle of the night creeped out by it because it was something that was on my mind before I went to sleep. And now I have to get out of bed and write it because it's fucking terrifying.
So there's Tales of Heart and Edgar Allan Poe and you're starting to sort of get into horror. Is there any sort of like on the movies or, you know, comics or anything that you were consuming as you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had the benefit of, you know, and it's funny because people sometimes react in horror to this when I bring it up. But my mother was an absolute horror obsessed person. She would wake me late at Friday night to come down and watch whatever the Friday night horror movie was on one of the two channels we had at the time. And then aside from that, so I was, I think maybe 8, 9, 10, I was watching Salem's Lot, The Shining. I was, you know, the only thing I had to shield my eyes from was any kind of explicit sex scenes or nudity. I was like, look away, which, you know, I didn't. But it was that, and she was bringing home Stephen King books and James Herbert and Ramsey Campbell, all that kind of stuff. So I wasn't allowed to read those, but I read them anyway. You could just wait until she went to work and then I'd creep into her room and take him out of her drawer and then, you know, hide him under my mattress. You know, what most people were doing with porn magazines, I was doing with horror novels.
Yeah. Scaring yourself silly in the bedroom. I like it.
Yeah. Porn can be scary in the right ways.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Was there any sort of particular horror movies you watched and you or books you read you couldn't sleep, like that had a really sort of lasting effect on you? Like a scarring effect, I guess.
Well, no, nothing ever scarred me. It was like the books, the other stuff, it just excited me. It was like, I remember after watching all of these things on a Friday night, I would wait until my mother needed to use the bathroom before I would go and wait outside the bathroom for my turn. I would not go up the stairs by myself because it was light at the bottom and dark at the top, and I was fucking convinced there was something up there.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it did get to me. I was scared, but I was also thrilled by the feeling. You know, it seemed to me that I had a pretty secure life at the time and there was no exterior dangers I was aware of, but I still felt this kind of, I don't know how to describe it, but the intoxication of being scared was just...
There's something quite titillating about being like scared shitless.
That's, that's exactly the word. Yeah, yeah. And I loved it. So I would say that at the time, the ones that I recollect the most that had that effect on me were The Omen.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember a thing about that movie years later, except for the sheets of glass flying off the back of the truck and
relieving
even corner of his head, and Pet Sematary, which I read when I think I was 13.
Oh, that book.
Yeah,
I can still, any time I think about that book now, I can still. Do you remember at the end where he describes the cat and basically the way that, well, not that, that's not the end, but the way the cat smells, the earthy sort of smell? I can literally just, anytime someone brings up that book, that's what I get in my mouth and nose.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'll tell you what it was for that. Weirdly enough, like The Omen, when I couldn't really recall it, I could just remember that the last part. For Pet Sematary, but there were two things that got me from that stayed with me forever. One was the scene where he's after burying Gage in the cemetery and he's walking back and there's something. It's just described as something enormous in the woods beside him.
Oh, yeah, but he never actually goes into detail as to what it is.
And that taught me the appeal of... The
unsmall.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other part of it was when they pull the dead cat off the grass and it's frozen and it makes this crunching sound. That was the complete opposite side of the scale. You have this unseen, mysterious thing, and then you have somebody ripping a fucking cat off the grass.
So you won your Bram Stoker in 2004.
Yes.
Which is obviously a fantastic achievement. So congrats on that. Probably about 13 years too late. but in that sort of 13 years, I've heard a lot of people seem to argue that horror is a dying art, that there's little audience for that kind of thing. But obviously there are people, we've spoken to people on the podcast that are still making a success of the genre. What would you say are the biggest changes in horror in the last 13 years? And how has that shaped the way that you wrote then to how you write now, if it has at all?
It's a great question. I mean, I don't think I'm entirely aware of, like, I'm sure there absolutely are, but I don't think I'm as attuned to the changes in what I've written. I would say that I put that more down to development as a writer, because I think that the art of writing is something that you're never good enough at. Like, I mean, everything I write needs to be better than the last thing. I'll never probably write what I consider to be a fantastic showstopper of a novel. It doesn't matter what reviewers or readers say at the end of the day. It basically, it comes down to your own satisfaction with what you write, and we're never satisfied, ever.
Yeah, yeah.
You can just do well enough and that's it. And if it entertains people and people like it, job done. If you can make a living at it, even better. But ultimately, you always, everything I've written to date, I look back on it and go, shit, I wish I'd just given that another couple of months and gone back to it again.
Mm.
But you got to let go, or you drive yourself insane.
So, sometimes I feel like when something goes down well, I feel like I tricked them. Just for that moment, I tricked them. But they don't know I'm a fraud.
No, that's exactly right. It is. You think you're after pulling some magic trick and you live in fear of being exposed, you know?
Yeah.
Mm.
But to properly address the questions. I'm not really aware of any kind of changes in what I've written to maybe cater to a shift in the audience. I wouldn't say that at all. I've always just written what I wanted to write. Some of it has been very popular, some of it less so. I just write what I feel compelled to write. I don't really have much control over it. But as regards the market itself or how horror has changed, I mean, as long as I've been doing this, and even before I was writing professionally, I was reading books like Dance Macabre by Stephen King, where even back in the early 80s, people were proclaiming the death of horror, and they always will, every single year. And while the success of horror tends to be cyclical, given changes in, given changes in the market, or I don't know, I think if there was a change, I think there's probably less readers, not genre specific. I just think that with the advent of smartphones and computer games and all this kind of stuff, you know, as that has become the dominant technology and the more prevalent technology, people have to fight more to have either the time or the inclination to sit down and focus on something like a 500-page book.
Yeah, that's probably where our success with the other stories comes from, because that's all audio, which is easy to digest.
Yes, exactly. That's actually a very good point, because with Kindle and with digital books, there has kind of been a leveling out where you see the people who won't read hardcovers anymore are suddenly reading digital, and it's more accessible, and that's great. But I've seen, myself personally, I've seen a huge rise in audiobook audiences. Like there was, you cut to 5 or 6 years ago and you asked people what their preferred method of reading was, and you'd have probably, let's say go back 6 or 7 years, you'd probably have 75% print, 10% digital, and the rest would be audio. Now I couldn't even hazard a guess. I think that, you know, it's audiobook is huge. And it's the thing I get asked the most is, can you make this title available in audio? When is this coming out? When is that? And it's, you know, it's crazy. The demand for it's huge. But so I think while the method of delivery has changed and people's tastes in medium tends to shift, I don't know that I buy into the whole, you know, there may be less readers, but I think as far as horror readers go, they'll never die. You know, it's always there to read the next thing and clamoring for more. And I don't think that's ever...
I feel like horror is like one of those human nature things. We've been telling scary stories like around a campfire, you know, since way back in the day. I mean, I was just going to ask, you write a lot, you've written a lot of short stories. Would you consider yourself more of a short story writer or a novelist, or is it just in between for you?
Well, it's tricky because I have written more short stories than anything. So I guess by that definition, I am a short story writer. Mm. But it's not because of any preference. It's because I find novels a hell of a lot harder to write.
When you've got an idea for a short story. And this is why I think I prefer writing short stories, is because when you go outside, you just get an idea, you see something, you just go home and just crank one out and then write a short story.
Well, it is. I mean, it could be the sound of the tap dripping in the bathroom.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Trigger something and there you go, five pages later you have a saleable short, you know.
Yeah,
but for books I tend to have the core idea for them and then kind of set it aside and let it develop itself over a period of a couple of years before I feel comfortable sitting down and writing it.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of definition, yeah, I write more short stories and novellas, so could be classified as, you know, leaning that way, but it's not because I want to. I'd much prefer to be one of these guys who can throw out two novels a year. I'm never going to be that person, much to my agent's chagrin, but it's, you know, it's more that I have to build it. And, yeah. And it's, to me, it's like building a mansion. I have to just do it one block at a time, and however long it takes for it to actually be ready, that's how long it takes. I can't force it.
See, I find that really interesting because I love the idea of writing short stories, and I'll get ideas sort of left, right and center. But I'm reverse engineered in that I feel guilty if I'll sit down and spend an hour, 2 hours writing a short story when I could be putting that towards something larger. And I'm not sure what that reason might be, but I feel like I want to write more short stories, but I'm more pushing towards novels of a standard thing that gets you from where we are to full time writing.
Yeah. It is definitely true that, I mean, the way in is definitely with a novel. But the thing is, too, that you also have to, at all costs, be true to yourself. Because the likelihood of you saying, well, I'm writing all these short stories I'm really proud of, I'm selling them. I mean, you do it the right way. Short stories and particularly novellas can get you a lot of attention. And that can parlay your way in as well if you have that body of work behind you. But the last thing I would say do is to sit down and write a book for the sole purpose of getting your way in, because you're compromising yourself from the outset. It's not the reason to do it. The reason to do it is because it won't let you alone and you have to.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you feel about, so the general consensus, more so in the indie market right now, is to, you know, pump out novels like extremely quickly. How does that vibe with you?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I think that more power to you if you can do it. I don't have a whole lot of faith in the quality of pumped out products like that. I think that, and maybe it's because of how I come at it myself, I don't know. But I mean, there is this temptation to be constantly in everybody's face with your work, to constantly try to be owning social media. I mean, everybody's eyeballs all the time. And I don't know, it's something distasteful about that to me. I mean, I think there's a white winner market stuff in the wrong way, but the idea that you have to keep shoving books out the door makes it sound more like McDonald's.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I feel like it's difficult to, I feel pressured to have to write and publish a shitload, and sometimes I don't really feel like I want to. But how do you feel about it, Dan? Because you're writing a lot at the minute as well, writing and publishing a lot of novels.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I think in a perfect world, it would be similarly to you, Keelan, where it's like you take your time, you produce that stuff. I think, I mean, for me, it feels like at the minute I'm trying to just find the way to become a full-time writer. Yeah. And once I've found that way in, I'll be able to slow down, lean back and actually go to the stuff that is a bit more pure to my heart, because I'm finding that with a couple of projects I have been struggling lately, and I've been trying to work out why. And to be honest, I do think it is because when I released my first novella in, I think it was the end of 2015, that was purely just a passion project. Everything that then followed until me and you, Luke, with They Rot, They Remain and Lazarus, they've all been absolute passion projects. And then everything else that's come after has been very much like, if I do this, this is more about the step that it takes, as opposed to this is the stuff that deep down in my heart I want to write. But strategically thinking and trying to move forward and trying to work out the best way of going from where I am to where I want to be.
Yeah.
And if an opportunity presents itself that could essentially shortcut it without like
making the process crap, but shortcut that and get me to the point where I can, you know, do this full time, then that's kind of where my head is at. But it's difficult sometimes.
Why do you think, like what you just said there, I mean, and I completely get it, but why do you think that a passion project could not be the way in for you? Why does it have to be two separate things?
Just, I mean, that is a fair question. It's a fair question. I think it's more that from what I've seen from people, it's the passion project. It seems to be more of a unicorn project, a bit more of a lucky star that your work will hit and you will be one of those guys that are successful. I mean, me and Luke on our books that we've done together, they're steadily growing in income, and with every release we're seeing growth, which is awesome. But I mean, I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say at the minute, so I won't say too much, but I have been presented with one of these opportunities that is essentially someone picking you up and putting you up there by writing in someone else's universe for a bit. Yeah. And I guess the argument is there's nothing that will stop you from doing that passion project or making it more your passion project. But I guess it's just that feeling that it seems a lot rarer. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. But at the same time, though, it seems like you're already putting a lot of roadblocks in your own way before you even get to the place where it's what's commercial. I mean, that's for editors and agents to decide what's going to sell and what isn't. If you're already deciding what won't, or that it's not the thing that's going to get you in the door, you're hamstringing yourself from the outset. I mean, because the thing that you want to be the thing that introduces your name to the world and to a whole new legion of readers and to commercial success, perhaps, who knows, is the thing that was a passion project. It should be you. It should be everything that you wanted the world to see should be in that.
Yeah.
And if you look at it as a case of, well, I'll write this because it'll get me in the door. If you do that and you're not being true to yourself and the rest of the world can see that, they don't have any drive to pick up the next thing you write that is your passion project.
So I mean, that has crossed my mind.
Yeah.
Always be absolutely 100% true to yourself when you're writing something. Always make it your passion project. If it isn't, you're doing it for the wrong reasons.
Can we call this episode Keelan Gives Dan Therapy?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But now
there's no obligation to listen to me because I've made my own fucking mistakes, but I've been doing it long enough too that I know that I'd rather not write at all than write something for the wrong reasons, you know. That's why I write so slow. I just won't do it. I will not peddle stuff out the door for someone else's agenda. It has to be my own. It has to be what I want.
Do you feel like Dan, so you're in a very difficult, well, busy day job. Do you feel like you're looking for a way out of that into a sort of more comfortable, fulfilling, you know, writing job, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that's a factor. I mean, if it was to get to the point where I could not do, I don't hate my job, just in case anyone I work with is listening, but I honestly don't hate it. I love the stuff that I do. Obviously every job comes with its trials, its tribulations, but in a perfect world, I'd be full time. I'd be doing this stuff, working towards the audio stuff with Hawk and Cleaver, you know, everything else that we do, just making that huge. But yeah, I guess it's just trying to find the right way to get to that point. And I have huge, you know, respect for guys like you, Keelan, that have managed to make everything that you do, your passion projects, just roll and roll and roll to the point that you can do it full time. But I guess the thing is with anything that we do as writers is there are so many different paths. There are so many different ways and you don't really know what's going to kick off. So you're right in a way when you say that, you know, I'm already hamstringing, and that is something else that I could open up and explore. But at this point, I don't really know which way. Do you know what I mean? I'm sure like a lot of listeners will be the same. If anyone out there is writing, you have that point where you know where you want to go, but it's trying to find the road that will get you there. And it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, that's absolutely true. And it's incredibly familiar. I mean, that was me my whole life wondering, what's going to happen? What should I write? What's going to do it? And that my own barrier in saying that I should be writing what's selling. I should be writing this. I should be writing that. And eventually I just realized I couldn't, that I wasn't any good at trying to write within the parameters of
don't know, whatever happened to be the in thing at the moment. And I just basically, the only things that worked for me were the things I felt that I had to write about. And mm-hmm. but I mean, your situation is hardly unique. I mean, I think that's writing. That's exactly it.
Yeah. And not just writing, I think maybe all artists out there who are trying to make...
Yeah, exactly. And it's the curse of it, it's the self-doubt.
Okay, so Dan, how are you feeling? Have you made a decision?
Don't listen to me. Run.
Don't listen to the guy that's already doing the dream. Now, to be honest, I mean, it's... Yeah, the writing gig's tough. And ultimately, it's... I mean, it's difficult to kind of follow back from that, really, because I know that I've got a lot inside at the minute that I know I want to do for, like, passion projects. I want to just get that out there and stuff. And seeing stuff that Keelan is doing is inspiring. And, I mean, I've read Sour Candy and was blown away by it. And that is the kind of stuff that long-term I'd like to be doing.
Yeah.
I guess it's just trying to find a way to essentially manufacture success, which is, like we say, that's where everyone's at the minute. And that's the big struggle. That's why we have these podcasts, to talk to people that have made it, to people that are still trying to get there, just to try and share some of those lessons. Because yeah, everyone takes a different path completely. And I find it incredibly interesting to see the different paths and to see what works. But yeah, I probably won't make any decisions right now.
that's fine, yeah. So Keenan, so Sour Candy, I do have to say Sour Candy was, I think maybe one of the favorite things I read earlier this year or late last year. I read it, but I absolutely loved it. And anyone listening to this show who likes horror, you really need to get it. It's a weird sort of, it's got some cosmic horror sort of vibes going on. Yeah. I mean, what genre?
And the cover.
Yeah, the cover's amazing as well. Yeah. So nice work on it. It's really great.
Thank you. That was a strange one.
Where did the idea come from for that?
Honestly, the idea, and this is another case of kind of a method that's usually reserved for novels, but with that one, I had the idea about 3 years before I actually sat down to write it. And it was basically how it starts for the guy in the book. I went into Walmart one Saturday morning and was walking the aisles, and all of a sudden this kid in the candy aisle started shrieking his fucking lungs out. It was incredible. Hanging from his lips like fucking airbags, I'll never know. Oh yeah, I just basically imagined what would happen if I got home after feeling sorry for that woman and kid, that if I got home and the kid was waiting for me at home calling me daddy.
Yeah.
And he had altered my reality so that he'd clearly always been a part of my life and had convinced everybody else that's the truth too. And I don't know. I had the idea years before, and then I finally, just one day, it came back to me, and I sat down and I think I wrote it in the space of maybe a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's been doing well for me.
It's got to have been optioned, right? Because I imagine Jason Blum or someone's got to get it on that. It's so ripe for optioning.
Yep. It has. I can't really say much about it at the moment, but it's been optioned by one of the bigger ones, and hopefully it'll all come together and we might see something.
That'd be very cool. Yeah.
I'd love to see it, but I mean, there's a couple of things been optioned, and I've been around this block a bunch of times too, though, over the years, where there's mad enthusiasm for something and wait, and just never.
Blanky, the latest one, latest novella, I'm about 3/4 of the way through it. Again, we've got like a bit of a the dad-child sort of relationship, a different sort of take on it. But so when did you first start writing this one?
Man, that was kind of a quick one, actually. I started that about 2 months ago. I think it took me about 2 weeks to write the first draft of it. Then I set it aside, came back, and took another 2 weeks to rewrite it because there was problems. There was things I wasn't very happy with. But I'd say a month overall. And again, that was an idea that I had probably this time last year, and it just wasn't ready. It was much simpler in its origins. It was just basically about a killer child blanket. That was like, you know, I even knew at the time I came up with that it was a painfully ridiculous idea, and there was no way I was going to be able to market it.
Yeah.
How do you end up trying to one up other horror authors, or, you know, trying to one up yourself, I guess, because I guess one can argue that all horror has been done and that essentially it's just people finding their own spin on the same stuff. Is there anything that you think out of your works particularly that are sort of an exception to that statement?
Well, I always try to come, I mean, I'm not really interested in one-upping other writers. I think that we're all in the same boat and we're all trying to come up with something that works for the reader. But yeah, and everything's been done. I just try and come up with a new and unique take on it that interests me to write about it. Not necessarily how it's going to turn out in the end, because I don't usually know that.
Yeah.
But, and I customarily kind of reject about the first 10 iterations of the idea that occur to me, because okay, they're novel, but they're ultimately fucking stupid as well.
Yeah.
And as soon as I stop trying very hard to come up with a new slant on something, it'll come to me out of that.
So is there any sort of mediums that you sort of want to write in? You know, write for comic books, write for audio dramas maybe, or anything like that?
All of them. Yeah. I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
Yep. I've recently, there's been adaptations of my stories in John Carpenter's Tales.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Yeah, because I was looking, I was listening to his latest sort of album, and then I was on his website and I saw he did the comic, and I saw your name on one of them, and I was like, oh, that's, how did that come about?
Yeah, oh, it was really cool. It was, I think what happened was on Twitter one night, one of the writers from the first issue of that, the first anthology, had posted about it. And I tweeted at him and I said, what the fuck is this? I've never heard of this. Where do I get a copy? And that was legitimately my only interest. I just wanted to grab a copy because I love all things John Carpenter.
Yeah.
So he sent me the link to it. And I was like, that's fantastic. And he went off and started digging up some of my stuff and came back and said, we're currently reading for issue 2. And I said, not even sure if it was an invitation or not. I just don't. Well, yeah, I'll definitely love to send you something. And then he got Sandy King, John Carpenter's wife, in on the conversation. And that was it. I scripted my first comic book script in that. That was my challenge. I was like, okay, yeah, you're on board. We'll take the story. Great. Now script it. I went, oh shit, I've never done that before.
Yeah, the comic book script medium is quite like open, I think, right? So yeah. You can sort of kind of do what you want in a way.
Yeah, exactly. I just went away and took about a 3-week crash course on how to format it properly, and that we're off. I'd love to do stuff in every medium. I'm fascinated by all of it. I'd love to do theater, movies, obviously, but I'm pretty much open to all of it.
Cool. Would you like to write a short story for the other stories?
I was going to ask the same thing. Yeah, we do a horror short story podcast. Just coming on to 1 million downloads, Dan. I think we're about 50,000 away.
Well, let's get ready to celebrate.
Yeah, Keen. I'd love to get if you're interested. Anyway, get one of your stories on there if you fancy it.
Yeah, sure. Message me the info on it, and we can have a chat.
Cool. That's because, have you got any favorite like recent horror, like any sort of recent films that have come out that you particularly enjoyed?
Yeah, I just this past week I saw It. Which I really liked, and Mother by Darren Aronofsky, which I really like as well. And I think I am probably one of three people on the planet who like that, but it worked.
Yeah, I really liked it. There's some aspects that, like the allegory was a bit heavy-handed for me, but I always think maybe I'm just too stupid. I'm sure there's maybe like something deeper happening that I'm just going over my head. I don't know, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like his movies anyway. And this one, kind of, I took from it was the whole creativity artist bullshit.
Right.
And
yeah,
later I read more and thought, oh wow, I completely missed the fucking point. But that's what I love about it.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, you can watch something, and then I can't remember the last time that a movie had so many people talking. I mean, it certainly has created a dialogue. And I think good art is meant to be argued about, and you're allowed to hate it. You're allowed to love it.
Yeah.
But it's fun.
You know, every time the most questions I've been asked, it's the most questions I've been asked about anything the last couple of weeks since I saw it. Did you see it? What did you think of it?
Yeah, it's one of those films. Out of any film I've seen in a long time, I'm really interested to hear what other people thought it meant.
Because I'm so disappointed when somebody I really like and respect comes back and says that was a pile of shit.
Well, yeah, I don't understand why they're so dismissive, because it is a weird film. Like, I don't feel like it's the correct answer. Do you know what? It's not like trying to
Right. Yeah. And it's amazing how many people have to declare it the worst movie they have ever seen in their life.
Oh, that's today's generation, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Okay, so we've got a few more questions, and then we'll do a quick fire round, if that's okay, which are 10 short questions. So I just want to quickly ask, if everything you ever made got burned or became corrupt and you didn't have a proper backup solution in place, and it all disappeared except for one book or one story, what would you like it to be and why?
Holy crap, that's an amazing question.
Thank you.
That really is. I'm used to being asked a certain kind of question. That is a great question, man. Wow. Jesus.
Yes. We can loop back around if you want to, let it percolate a little bit.
Oh, no. Let me do this one now, because that's got me engaged.
That's a challenge now.
Oh, yeah. Big time. I would say probably my first hardcover collection. I would say probably the number 121 to Pennsylvania, because I've done a bunch of collections since. But I think as a representation of my work when I wasn't taking myself quite so seriously and I just basically ran with it.
Yeah.
I think I'm the happiest with that. Plus it came out from Cemetery Dance Publications.
Wow.
That book was absolutely astonishing. It's a beautiful book to look at. So probably that, I think.
And is that, my answer has changed. Is that hardcover on Amazon, or where can people get that?
Yeah, well, you'd probably find the hardcovers. It's out of print now. You'd probably find them on eBay, but the paper backup is on Amazon.
And what book would you say you've learned the most from out of all of your books?
I would say definitely Kin, the novel. I think that's the closest I've ever come to actually doing what I set out to do and incorporating elements of things that I had learned but never been able to put into practice, or at least not any grown-up way.
Yeah. But
I think after I wrote that, I was able to be more mature in looking at my own technique.
Whoa. It's interesting answer. You
know what's even more disturbing is that was actually me.
I just saw, so we're friends with a pretty big bookstagrammer, which are these like people who take pictures of books and review them. And Kin actually popped up on Dan on Joe, is it Johan a real name?
Yeah.
Kin popped up. So maybe some more sales will come that way. I don't know. But nice. It's cool to see it out there in the wild anyway.
She's got like 16,000 followers or something.
And they're like really active, engaged followers as well. Yeah.
I think, I don't know did she follow me or I followed her at some point, but I know who you're talking about. And what's interesting actually now, and I won't exactly call it breaking news because most people don't care, but I did a mini dance yesterday, but funnily enough, for a book that's 6 years old now, Kin, we just sold translation rights to Russia.
Sorry, it's nice. just breaking up. I didn't quite catch that. So you have some great news.
Translation,
right? Right. Okay. Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Just gonna say that the all my secret, my millions are buried in the, and then it'll cut.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
No, we just sold mass market translation rights to Russia yesterday for that novel. 6 years after it came out, so that's pretty.
Congratulations.
Great. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. So we'll see how that does, and hopefully it'll lead to more stuff down.
Yeah.
It's nice to see it get a broader audience.
Mm.
Great stuff. Okay, so Keelan, are you ready for the quick fire round?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Dan, do you want to take the first question or would you like me to?
You pick.
I'll go first. Okay, number one, Stephen King or Clive Barker?
Stephen King.
Would you rather live in a world where you're constantly bored or constantly bombarded with entertainment?
constantly bombarded with entertainment.
What's your favorite alcoholic beverage?
Carlsberg.
USA all the way? Or USA, I don't know. It's okay.
Oh, Jesus. USA all the way, because I live here, so that's...
Yeah. Number five, the last book you read?
The last book I read was... Shit, I just read it. What was it? I'm losing my mind. Finders Keepers, Stephen King.
Cool. Nice. Who's the one person you'd like to meet?
Eva Green.
I wonder why. Okay. The biggest hobby outside of writing?
Video games, probably.
Who's your favorite writer?
Cormac McCarthy.
So you're in a packed cinema and you're about to watch the latest film you've been dying to see, and there's a kid on his phone in front of you tweeting. What do you do?
Make him eat it.
And number 10, where can we follow you and your work?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And my website is myname.com.
Cool. Okay, go on.
Yeah, I'm on Goodreads as well, I think. I think that's all of it.
Yeah, so I definitely recommend Sour Candy. Blanky, as I said, I'm 3/4 way through. It's pretty amazing so far. Don't spoil it. I'm enjoying it. I think your prose is so rich, and I always like to see that, especially, I don't know, I just feel like we're in a bit of a sort of prose-light world at the minute, and it's nice to see some very good writing, I guess. So thanks again for coming on, man. It's been amazing.
Lovely. Thanks very much for having me, and I appreciate the kind words.
Cool. So just a quick thanks to Disasterpiece for the intro and outro music, Acast for hosting the podcast, the listeners for listening, our patrons over at patreon.com/HawkandCleaver. And thanks to Dan, my co-host, for being here, because without you, I'd be alone. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much.
And once again, thanks to Keelan. Cheers, man.
Thank you, Keelan.
Thanks, guys.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Story Studio podcast. Still hungering for some podcast goodness? Then why not check out our other show, The Other Stories? Oh, and did you know, every time you leave us a review in the iTunes store, a puppy is born. Cute, eh? Anyway, toodle pip.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.